Welcome to the OnFIF podcast.
Hello and welcome to the OnFIF podcast. I'm Ellie Groves from OnFIF, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Max Castelli, Head of Strategy, Global Sovereign Markets at UBS Asset Management, and Athanasios Orfanides, Professor of the Practice of Global Economics and Management at MIT, Sloan School of Management, who has served as Governor of the Central Bank of Cyprus between 2007 and 2012, who is Member of the Governing Council of the ECB. So they are both excellently placed to talk about the future direction of the ECB monetary policy and the implication and the role of the markets within this. We'll sort of split this podcast into three pillars, but we'll see how we get on. Having just had a very lively discussion with both the panelists before now, I'm excited to get straight in. The first sort of pillar will be looking at inflation and what the ECB might be doing with QE and their current monetary policy stance. Then we'll look at reserve management in central banks and the implication that this interest rates and inflation has on diversification in reserve management. It's a conversation that Max and I had a little while ago with David Marsh as well. So we'll delve into that. And then thirdly, we will look at the biggest risks and trends that are yet to come. So first of all, Athanasios, when we spoke around 6 months ago, you said that the ECB was perhaps not doing enough to ensure that it hits its targets of 2% inflation. Obviously, in December, we had a 5% inflation. But what are your thoughts on that? Are we going to see inflation back to 2% as the ECB have said, give or take? I think Philip Lane from the ECB said it would be 1.9% towards the end of this year. Or do you think that the unconventional monetary policy actually needs to stay around for longer and they need to see through this current high inflation?
Let me first say thank you. Glad to be here with you and with Max to discuss these issues today. And I'm going to start by pointing out the basics for how monetary policy should be evaluated in real time. It's true that especially in the second half of last year, we had some nasty surprises with supply problems that have affected the global economy, and that did result in an increase in inflation that was considerably higher than was expected in the first couple of quarters of 2021. But monetary policy works with a lag. When I look at whether monetary policy is correctly calibrated for a central bank that has a 2% inflation objective, as the ECB now has, what I do is I look ahead and I say, is monetary policy at present consistent with the inflation projection that the ECB and other institutions converging to 2%? That's the goal at the policy relevant horizon. The policy relevant horizon is a couple of years out. And frankly, when I look at the latest projections of the ECB in December, for example, I was quite surprised to see that in the baseline scenario, according to the ECB's December 21 inflation projections, inflation is converging to just 1.8% in 2024. And that's quite a bit below 2 in the forecast horizon. You should be exactly at 2. And what's worse than that is they then describe two alternative scenario, a mild scenario and a severe scenario. And none of the scenario are above 2. So it's 2 or below. So my concern actually is very similar to the concern I had communicated to you after the conclusion of the policy review. The ECB said that it had changed its strategy, that it wants to follow policy that is clearer, centered around 2%, a 2% inflation goal, but is not implementing policy in a manner that would be consistent with that. Had the ECB be implementing policy consistent with a 2% inflation goal, then policy should be calibrated so that at the forecast horizon, a couple of years out and beyond, the probability and distribution of inflation outcome should be centered at 2. And they still haven't done that.
Thank you. I think that's very clear. And I think responsive of also what the strategy set out. So thank you for bringing that. We shouldn't forget that that strategy is still quite young. So they should be adhere. Well, we'd all hope that they'll be adhering to it for a while yet. Max, from your perspective at UBS, what do you see and within the market analysis that you've been doing?
Yeah, sure. First of all, let me just mention what are our current forecasts, which of course are also based on the December communication from the ECB. Basically, our view in a nutshell is that inflation in the euro area has probably peaked, but definitely risk remain on the upside. So in our forecast for the moment, we think that we will see a gentle decline in the course of this year, largely because of a softening of the supply side bottlenecks. We also start to see actually in these days, for instance, we see production in the auto industry picking up a little bit. Apparently, some of the bottlenecks that were impacting heavily, for instance, German car production are starting to ease in some way. We think this will continue. And eventually, we think that inflation will continue falling and actually reach 2% in December 2022, and then eventually going below 2% in 2023. Now, of course, this means that when I say up risk on the upside, what are these risks? But fundamentally, we see three which I would like to mention. The first one is definitely energy price. We are starting to see that. There is also the twist of the geopolitical factors impacting on them. I'm thinking about what's going on in Ukraine and the confrontation between Europe, the West in general, and Russia over Ukraine. Of course, the supply side, the bottlenecks, I think everybody was expecting this to clear actually much faster than what happened in reality. And so we can also might require a little bit more extra time before this adjustment on the supply side take place. And I would say that probably the most important one is the wage dynamics within the euro area. We do not see yet, let me reformulate. We see more risk of wage pressure in the US rather than in Europe, because also the position that the US is in from an economic cycle point of view. But overall, I think that's also a factor that we should monitor very closely within the euro area. Maybe let me mention something about the ECB, the fact that in reality, we should also put the ECB into the global context. It's not just the Fed, but the global rates tightening is a process which actually started already last year with many emerging markets accelerating on that. Many emerging markets actually acted much earlier than developed market central banks because in some way they wanted to immediately stop inflation expectation from rising, probably also because they have a little bit more recent experience in inflation compared to developed market economies, where inflation has become a problem just in the second part of 2021, actually. So from that point of view, it might well be the ECB will feel a little bit the pressure of this global rates tightening, and the market seems to have already signaled that. We had some rising pressure as well in the euro area. I think we saw some for a short period of time, German interest rate rising above zero, which was something also relatively new, despite no change really in the interest rate policy from the ECB at the moment. So from that point of view, I think it is important to see as well as the market will, what the market expect in the next few months as we see the data coming in.
I think what we've got there, thank you very much, Max. I think what we've got there is perhaps the view from Athanasios, who's saying what he would like or what you would like, or perhaps what needs to happen if they want to reach that 2%. And then Max, the indication from what the markets are seeing that might happen in reality. So my first question kind of back to that is, do you think that the pandemic emergency purchase program PEPP will continue? I mean, it's due to be disbanded in any ways, or put into other QE programs. But what do you think will happen to that in March? Or would you think there will be an extension of that for the next 3 months to June, especially as we've seen Omicron? And how do you think that, I mean, this is real crystal ball indications, but what indications are you seeing from the conversations that you've heard? And I mean, within the public, that where do you expect those decisions to be made? So maybe Max, for you first, do you think that, and I guess we've talked about interest rate hikes, but actually what do you think will happen with QE?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, the market is expecting the ECB policy will remain geared towards basically continuing on the expansion. So we use the terminology extracting duration from the market. And let's say any conversation about what now from QE we are moving to QT or quantitative tightening is still a little bit few years away. So, but definitely it came a little bit earlier than before. I remember that in 2021 in June when we made our survey of central banks and we were asking by when do you expect the current monetary policy stance, which include of course both the interest rates and QE, to change in Europe. This was actually, the expectation was for 2024. So really, really in a very distant time, something that the market probably is not even able to really consider when it's so far, when it's so distant in time. Instead, now the market is starting to think a little bit more about that. Then there are a lot of different aspects as well in terms of other programs, which could also in some way have an impact on the overall level of liquidity within the euro area. I'm also thinking, for instance, about the TLTRO, which of course also has some implications. So overall, still distant in future, but definitely something which is look a little bit more closely as something which eventually will hit the market. But on the US side, the discussion, of course, is different. And I let Athanasios on that comment from the US angle.
Yeah, that's us. Please do offer and also put into context some of the things that Max touched on around the Fed decisions and impact within the ECB, because obviously central banks, much like us, do not operate in a vacuum anymore or ever did.
Indeed, they never did. So let me first touch on the Fed's monetary policy. And of course, we are expecting to see details of that. So it's both interest rate and balance sheet policy matter for determining monetary policy conditions. And the Fed is in a different position than the ECB is, because the U.S. economy is actually in a much stronger position than the ECB. Part of that is that the fiscal response has been, in the end, more forceful in the United States than what was predicted at the beginning of the pandemic, when it looked to be similar. And the Fed will have to tighten significantly this year. And they will tighten both by raising interest rates and by adjusting the balance sheet. And this will have implications for the ECB. This will have global implications. Longer term interest rates globally will start rising, simply because the term premium will be rising. And this is something that other central banks will need to take into account in their policies. But again, the ECB is not the Fed. It would actually be one of the risks, if we're going to discuss risks later on, how the risks to identify would be that if the ECB were to try to follow the Fed in tightening right now, that would be a problem for the euro area. Now, let me come back to the euro area. What can I say about balance sheet policy at the ECB? Well, I'm still waiting, to tell you the truth, the ECB to clarify two things as part of their strategy that they did not really do a very good job clarifying last year. Number one, they did not really clarify how they would adjust other balance sheet programs once pandemic emergency purchase program stops. I do expect that the PEP, as they call it, will stop this year. That's not an issue. They have already given indication about that, but they have not clarified as a strategy issue what they will do with other programs that affect the size of the balance sheet that are quite significant. That's one thing. And then the other thing that neither the ECB nor the Fed have done. This is actually a common weakness in central banks and advanced economies in recent years, is that they have not clarified the substitutability of their balance sheet and interest rate instruments that they're incorporating into their own analysis. I mean, it makes quite a bit of a difference if you tell me that that they believe that 100 basis points of interest rate increases are equivalent to X or 2X of imbalance sheet adjustment, and unfortunately neither the ECB nor the Fed have been very clear on that. So there is, I cannot really assess what they would do with quantitative easing, because there are these two different parameters that that they need to shed some more clarity, and I hope that they will do that in not too long.
Maybe just to add, Eli, on the market reaction before we move to the second topic, which of course, so this also, I think my comment also prepared the ground for that conversation. I think it's interesting to see how the market reacted to this. So basically, we are facing a change in monetary policy framework. We can debate about the timing and the different geographical, the different speed across different regions. But overall, the feeling in the market is that we are in the middle of a transition from one regime to another, and we will see how long this transition will last. But fundamentally, there are two factors which impact the market. One, of course, is the level of interest rates. And let me say that the market so far seems to have absorbed this. Think about taper tantrum that we had a few years back. So far, the market basically was convinced that the Fed was behind the curve, so welcome, in a way, I would say, already in the last part of last year, the fact that interest rate needs to rise. There was no real market dislocation. Now, on the balance sheet, on the quantitative tightening, the discussion is very different, because this impacted directly asset price. Basically, there is a buyer out there in the fixed income market called the Fed or ECB who is buying a lot of stuff. This buyer is communicating that in a way or another will start eventually to withdraw from the market. This inevitably will have an impact on the market. And this is going to be very interesting, because I think that's something that we enter into more uncharted territory, in the sense that if I think about the impact on market of a tightening of interest rate, at least we have history telling us how different asset classes perform. But if you think about it, we don't have a lot of history about balanced quantitative tightening and the impact on asset price, because we are really in uncharted territory. It seems that we are in a phase where really there will be a substantial withdrawal of quantitative easing over the next few years, and we are in uncharted territory. So the market will definitely feel the impact of that.
Thank you, Max. Talking of uncharted territory, and as you say, links in with what you were saying. When you and I spoke with David in the podcast just before Christmas, we went in towards how central banks, reserve managers are operating within the environment of negative yields, or even negative yields, and moving in diversification and moving into potentially riskier assets around equities and that trend. Do you see, I mean, a question I put to you before we officially started this, but I'm going to re-put to both of you and tease out a little bit further for the benefit of the audience. But around the time, obviously, equities, the research that OMFIF did in our global public investor survey was that, what we found was that actually the equities that central banks, which isn't a huge amount and isn't a high percentage, but the equities that central banks, reserve managers do have on their books actually seem to be a reliable asset during, especially for classified diversified reserves, despite the rapid fall in March and April 2020, the global stock markets rebounded quickly. They demonstrated their ability to absorb this shock, store value, and generate returns. So it seemed like quite a solid investment for this global shock. In how that played out. While we're talking around interest rate hiking cycles and a change in the environment, as you say, and actually, does that cause, would that keep you up at night if you were a central bank reserve manager that was looking at your investments in equities? And what trends have you seen? Do you think that the equity trend will continue? I think let's start with Max, and then we'll go to Athanasios. But Max, what do you see and think around this?
Yeah, I mean, here there are a lot of arguments to be mentioned and put on the table, because there are different factors. But first of all, let's start where this comes from. So when central banks around the world after the great financial crisis launched the so-called unorthodox monetary policy, Of course, this has a massive impact on the level of on the return that central banks can generate on their reserve, because interest rates suddenly collapse. And actually, the one which collapse are the one which really interest central banks, which are the short duration government bonds, which for a question of liquidity, they've always been the bulk of the reserve of central banks. So what central banks have been doing since then, particularly the one with a high level of foreign exchange reserves, they started to diversify across the fixed income space. So we see central banks buying corporate bonds, investment grade. We see central banks buying more asset-backed securities. We see central banks, in some cases, also buying more emerging market debt, for instance, in hard currency. Once again, investment grade, most of them, some of them, actually most of them as well. So from that point of view, this has been a trend which has not only concerned central banks, but concerned any institutional investor. Of course, central banks, because they have a particular mandate, they will not buy into private equity. But if you take this trend, for instance, for pension funds, meant that many pension funds have increased their allocation to alternative asset classes. Now, this strategy has been ongoing for a very long time, with some difference across the world. The central banks in Asia have been at the forefront of these trends. Then it was followed by the Europe and Middle East and Africa. And actually, Latin American central banks remain the most cautious from that perspective, for local reasons of macroeconomic management. But overall, these trends, first of all, they paid off very well. Now, this paid off very well for two reasons. First of all, because central banks said they diversified, but also in a very cautious way. So central banks didn't move to portfolio with 50 or 60% of equity. What they did is that they diversify part of their massive fixed income portfolio, 10, 15, max 20% into equity. And the second reason, so they took a diversification, but in a controlled way, I would say. Secondly, it paid very well because, as you know, the low interest rates and the very ample liquidity in global market push up the price of all risky assets, including listed equity. Now, what happened is 2021 changed that. What happened is that, first of all, the central banks start to see losses on their short duration government bond portfolio. And this is very important. This is the first time that central banks actually, it's the first time in almost 30 years that they saw losses on such a portfolio. Why? Because the increase in interest rate has been actually concentrated in this 2 to 5 year duration bracket, which is actually where the losses were materialized. So from that point of view, central banks who had invested into equity, they receive some compensation for that, because the equity compensated for the loss on fixed income. And some central banks, the one which instead remain very conservative, very much focused on fixed income only, they suffer some losses. Not enormous, of course, but still negative return, which would go against the mandate of a central bank, which is at least capital protection in nominal terms. So from there, let me finish with an anecdote, which I found very... I had a call with the central banks for Northern Europe, which is very conservative. They didn't diversify like other central banks just a few days ago. And they told me, oh, we remember when you came here in 2015 advocating for diversification. And they told me, well, now we understand why. I think it was apart from the fact that at least is a premium to my consistency in advice over the years. But many central banks now are looking what to do in order to eventually alleviate the impact, at least during this transition period of rising interest rate, to at least move the return at least in positive territory. And this is something very important. And to finally answer your question, I think these trends will continue, of course, in a controlled way by looking at the market developments, but diversification so far has paid off in any market condition, and I think we'll continue doing so in the future.
Thank you very much. And to go to Athanasos, do you see this same question to you? Do you see this trend continuing? And also, what would the implications be for central bank independence as well? If there is the diversification and riskier assets on their books.
Sure. So let me differentiate myself from what Max says in part, and I will do this in part by first. talking about the part where I would agree with you. When Max describes the diversification benefits for institutional investors, I fully agree with that. And I think we have had a change in the past, I'm going to say, couple of decades. It has accelerated since the global financial crisis, when we had extremely low interest rates in government bonds, and that's going to continue. But central banks are not institutional investors similar to what we see in the private sector, and they do not have a profit-maximizing objective. They have a price stability objective, an economic stability objective. So their considerations and the drivers of their balance sheet are quite different. So if I focus on just central banks, no, I do not see the trend that we have seen over the past 10, 14 years, since starting with the global financial crisis in 2008, for the following reason. Much of what we have seen in some of the large advanced economy central banks, for example, was the need to adopt unconventional policy measures to ease monetary policy beyond what could be done by lower interest rates. So central banks did that. First with government debt, and in some countries there wasn't enough government debt to do this with, and then they had to do it with other assets. And in other countries, they actually realized that there were benefits in directly providing impetus in financial conditions in the private sector. So the Swiss National Bank is a fantastic example, doing exchange rate operations. That was a monetary policy operation. That was not an investment operation. The Bank of Japan also went into equities. But they did that beyond going beyond their purchases of treasury bonds. So again, it was a monetary policy operations. So if you ask me the question, suppose that we see interest rates rising over the next few years, and we see a reduction in the need of central banks to engage in such unconventional measures, what's the first thing they would get rid of? And my answer to that is the first thing they would get rid of is the elements in their portfolio that could create market distortions that central banks would not otherwise want to do, and that would be equities and corporate debt holdings and so forth. Those would be the first to go if central banks do not need them for monetary policy purposes.
No, I would like to add another twist, and we already have this conversation with Athanasios in the past, and of course, central bank or as an ex-central governor, I know that the monetary policy is definitely the dominant objective, so unquestionable. But still, I believe that, as I mentioned, when we ask central banks what are the objectives from an investment perspective for their reserve, as I mentioned, capital protection is the top one. I would say together with another one, which is liquidity. And this is a very important factor also to keep in mind when we talk about the equity market, because there was this view until a while ago that the most safe and liquid instrument is the U.S. Treasury market. True. I think it is still true, but we saw sometimes, particularly in period of market stress, we saw some issues about liquidity also in the U.S. Treasury market, which I know that has been addressed also by the regulators. And actually, the equity market is very liquid. Actually, even during 2008, you might have a problem to buy to trade a corporate bond, but you would not have a problem to sell a stock. So from that point of view, there is also this element of the liquidity management, which is very interesting. I just want to add that because I think the liquidity aspect of the conversation with central banks is also very important.
Well, but if I were to also add a comment to this, market disruptions in the government bond market is the sort of disruptions that a well-functioning central bank can definitely deal with extremely effectively. And this is why in well-functioning central bank, like in the United States, those disruptions do not persist. And if you do see a central bank where there are disruptions in the bond market, in the currency they control, that last for more than a few hours or a couple of days, that is an indication that that central bank is not operating correctly. That's not an indication that, that they should go into equity.
Absolutely. Also, Athanasio, let's not forget that if interest rate rise, which seems to me, at least this is our baseline scenario, maybe we can debate how much, but probably if things go as expected, that we will see a gradual rise in yields in developed market economy. And also, I think central banks would be very happy to move away from the zero interest rate level they've been in for a very long time. Also, the losses which some central banks might incur on their balance sheet would be substantial. And this, of course, also carries some reputational risk. You mentioned the case of the Swiss National Bank. The Swiss National Bank sits on almost a trillion of reserves, and many of them are euro bonds. If, for instance, interest rate in the euro over the next few years should really rise faster than expected or as expected, this will entitle losses, which eventually will also have a repercussion on the reputation of the central bank. So I think that's also something to keep in mind when we talk about diversification. It's not a speculative move, can also be a defensive move in certain market conditions.
I want to touch on that actually. I'm going to kind of circle us round as we are half an hour in or just under. It's been fascinating, but I want to circle us around to the future and looking at what the biggest risks might be that you envision for 2022. And actually, I wanted to touch on one of the conversations that we've been having at OnFIF and that comes up quite a lot within also our Sovereign Debt Institute, and is the issue of debt sustainability. So if you and if you see the interest rates rise within central banks, how much room do they really potentially have? Obviously, the central banks that we're touching on here are independent, but do you think that they will feel the pressure to ensure that especially within the COVID pandemic, there was huge amounts of fiscal investments that the central banks have adopted upon their books, and if they raise interest rates, what implications will that have on the global economic outlook? And do you see that as a risk, or do you see actually that keeping the interest rates low is a greater risk? So, Athanasios, where do you sit within that discussion?
Sure. So let me break this into two. And first, I will discuss what would be relevant for the Fed as a starting point, and then move on and discuss the additional complexities that the ECB, unfortunately, like it or not, faces, given the many governments it has to deal with and some issues with its monetary policy implementation strategy. So starting from the Fed. Yes, we are discussing, I think we agree that we're going to see interest rates rising this year and for the next several quarters. However, this does not change the assessment that the natural rate of interest, the equilibrium rate of interest that is really driving trend interest rates globally, is still incredibly low. So when we look at the debt sustainability questions, what is most important is what is the safe interest rate that applies for government debt, assuming a well-functioning central bank like the Fed, for example. And all the indications that I can see so far is that the low estimates of the natural rate of interest will continue to apply this year, and I have not seen any revisions that suggest a significant increase in the natural rate of interest projected in the next few years that would compromise debt sustainability questions. So if you have a cyclical increase in interest rates, that's okay. I think central banks should do this. I expect the Fed will raise the Fed funds rate actually above what they consider the neutral Fed funds rate in order to ensure that inflation will come back to 2% in accordance with the target. This is what I expect them to do. And in light of the low natural rate of interest levels, that is not going to create a problem with debt sustainability in the United States. We do need to have some consolidation on the fiscal side. I am assuming that that consolidation will take place in this scenario. We're not talking about governments that are running excessive primary deficits for years to come. Now, if I turn to Europe, the conditions with respect to the natural rate of interest are actually the same. If anything, the most recent estimates I've seen suggest that the natural short-term real interest rate for the euro area may be below estimates for the United States, could be zero, could be even slightly negative in some estimates. Under these conditions, even with a debt ratio that is higher than what we have now anywhere in the euro area, no debt sustainability issues would arise unless the ECB does not run policy correctly and allows credit spreads to appear similar to the credit spreads that the ECB tolerated, say, in 2011, 2012, and on various episodes since then. What we associate with the euro crisis, what the ECB is describing in the past several years as problems with the functioning of the monetary policy transmission mechanism and so forth. So I mentioned this because I don't really see debt sustainability issues in the euro area or in the United States as long as the ECB avoids problems with the transmission of monetary policy and problems with the with effectively spreads widening for no good reason, but simply because the ECB is not protecting governments from going to self-fulfilling adverse equilibria, which is what we had seen in the past. So what do I base this this analysis on? Well, the fact that in the euro area we do have a reasonable fiscal framework that does not really allow, has not allowed primary deficits to become too large in the past. And I haven't really seen reason to believe that the primary deficits of governments in the euro area will become larger in the future. Let me remind you, just to put this in perspective, for the past 10 years, if the ECB had been doing policy better, not allowing spreads to be on average as high as they have been from 2010 to 2020. Take a country like Italy. Italy was running primary surpluses year after year after year after year. Its debt to GDP ratio would have been consistently declining if the ECB had been running policy effectively protecting the spreads from being unnecessarily high. So I'm going to actually end this intervention by saying that when you talk about fiscal risks, one of the major risks I see for 2022 and 2023, in the case of the ECB, is that the ECB may make the mistake of allowing the expiration of a very, very important decision that was taken on April 22nd of 2020, which is to get rid of the dependence of its monetary policy operations on credit ratings. That is really the feature of policy that that the ECB has allowed to destabilize government markets in the past. The ECB has gotten rid of that during the pandemic, which is why markets are behaving better over the past couple of years. But the ECB has not yet clarified what the post-pandemic framework is going to be. So if you ask me about, you know, what are major risks in the euro area and what are major risks that could create what we might be calling debt problems and fiscal problems later on, it would be this detail. It's an implementation detail. It's all these things that we should not be worried about, a central bank actually not taking care of the plumbing of monetary policy. And we do not worry about these things for any other advanced central bank that I know of, except for this exception, the ECB.
Thank you very much. That was a very comprehensive answer. Max, you What do you see as the biggest risk within, if you're looking at the euro area, for the post-pandemic world?
Sure. Let me first of all follow up on this about the fiscal side, because of course the question of debt sustainability is very important. I think we should think about what happened with the pandemic. If we look at the world, and I'm referring mainly to the euro area here, before the pandemic, we had fiscal austerity, if you want, or austerity, and very loose monetary policy in terms of level of interest rate and amount of liquidity which was injected in the euro area. The pandemic has changed completely that. Basically, we have a paradigm shift in terms of political doctrine, where we move from austerity to deficit spending. So that's the shift that we had. So this means now what happened to monetary policy when we move into this new world where we don't have any more fiscal austerity. We will have to see what will happen once the pandemic is, the emergency is really over with the new fiscal rule, which, as you know, have been suspended. I'm sure that will be a very interesting debate. But this seems to me that given the challenge that the euro area has, and that would also include the energy transition and climate change and the infrastructure needed for all that, that probably they will find a way to at least allow for more flexibility, for instance, in terms of investments. And also the famous Next Generation Fund that could become maybe a little bit more permanent or something more long-term rather than a pure emergency plan, because actually it doesn't look like an emergency plan already now. If you look at the way it's been designed, it looks like more as a long-term or at least medium-term fiscal expansion policy. So from that point of view, I think the monetary policy, how will react? Of course, the market seems to believe a little bit, and I think there is also why interest rate, long-term interest rates are not rising too much. That ultimately, given the mass amount of debt which has been created as a result of the pandemic, really the central banks will not allow interest rate to rise too much, because this will create a lot of problems in terms of debt sustainability. Although I think this is a market a little bit wishful thinking as well. Central banks care very much about independence, and it's fundamental that they protect the independence, because the worst that could happen is that, of course, that we move in a situation where this independence is weakened, because that will make the macroeconomic situation a little bit more, if you want, hazardous than it's been so far. So I believe that we need to see what I think the central bank will not hesitate to eventually tighten more if inflation should, for instance, result in the end higher than what we are currently forecasting, that we should not forget. We all agree, at least we are agreeing in this podcast, that the rise in inflation in Europe at least is temporary or transitory, maybe a little bit longer than expected, this transition, but ultimately will fall back to the target rate. If this is not the case, I believe the ECB will probably not hesitate to increase interest rate because of the level of debt. Now, if I move and I link to the risk, the risk here, Atanasio mentioned the mismanagement of basically a policy mistake, which is is possible. I think this is a little bit something that, of course, worries everybody. I also put myself in the shoes of central banks. They have a very difficult job. Here, there are a lot of structural and cyclical factors impacting inflation. I believe it is not easy to really distinguish what is cyclical, which would require more activism on monetary policy, from which is structural, which in the end is something which needs to be accepted as a change in the underlying structure of the economy. I think these two factors interplay a lot and makes difficult the work. But I believe this is a possibility. So the one, for instance, that Atanasio mentioned. But I would say that if I have to put the one more on top of them, I think, first of all, the most obvious one is, of course, that the pandemic does not gradually goes away during the year, that we have a new variant, for instance, impacting us, which would force, again, new health measures. This, of course, would have a very big effect on the global economy, including Europe. And I would put probably the third one is China, which is a very important market for European exports. We saw how much the export machine has been back into full motion across Europe over the last few quarters. I'm an Italian. I saw some numbers about Italy. The export is at the maximum ever, ever, so even before the pandemic, in terms of volume. So this, of course, is an important driver. And in China, there are some important change going on, from the sort of reduction of debt in the real estate sector to the so-called regulatory crackdown of certain sector. So China is walking a very delicate balance between maintaining growth and at the same time adjusting its policy mix. Also there, we could have eventually a negative surprise if, for instance, the real estate fallout is much bigger than what is expected now. Final, I've mentioned among the risk factor, probably the geopolitics is interesting. Geopolitics is something that sometimes in the jargon of our industry we call tail risk, right? Tail risk is something that you always talk about it, but in the end, what do you, you cannot really do very much about it, right? But now we see how this is coming back. I mean, think about Ukraine. Think about as well the U.S. domestic midterm election, which could signal another change in policy in the U.S., which I think could have a repercussion globally. Think about the, what we mean, for instance, for the U.S.-China confrontation. So there are a lot of risk factors out there. The question is which one will materialize, and eventually if more than one will materialize at the same time, which is also an interesting aspect of the type of world we are in at the moment.
Well, thank you, Max. And thank you, Athanasis, for joining us. We are unfortunately out of time. I think that we could go on for far longer, though. So I'm very grateful for both of your time for this. And I'm sure we can pick up the conversation as well. Thank you to all that listen to the OnFIF podcasts. Please do leave a comment, review or question. And we are very pleased to have that engagement with you. So please do sign up to the rest of our podcast series. And thank you both as well for this interesting discussion.
Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFIF podcast.